So I appreciate the two last readings from the biography of Ajahn Chah, and in that spirit, I thought I'd start with a recollection of Ajahn Chah by one of his disciples who is fairly close to him, and this is a transcription from a Dhamma talk, and it's just 2 minutes. Sometimes with Ajahn Chah, he'd put on an appearance where he would just look like he was carefree. He didn't care about anything, like he was just doing everything easy, that he wasn't very ferocious. But in reality, all of us monks were all quite scared of him because we knew what his teaching methods were really like. But in saying that, there were a lot of examples where he showed great kindness to a lot of people. There was a case where there was one novice, just a little kid. But this novice, he was very naughty. He'd always be doing things and getting into trouble, and the monks didn't really like him. But Ajahn Chah was quite worried about him, and Ajahn Chah actually gave him a nickname, Monkey Novice. So as I said, nobody liked this novice. He was naughty. But Ajahn Chah used to really, really praise him and try to find the good in him. One thing that this novice was really, really good at, he could take Ajahn's false teeth and he'd clean them. He'd clean them really good and he'd scrub them and he'd make them clean as you could possibly get them. Because at that time, Ajahn Chah would eat betel nut, which makes your mouth all red. And this novice would clean those false teeth and they'd be shining. Basically, nobody saw any good in this novice, but Ajahn Chah found the good in him. What he was teaching everyone was that there is some good in everyone. And that's a recollection from Ajahn Anand. Ajahn Anand is one of the well-known and well-respected disciples of Ajahn Chah. He now has a monastery, Wat Mopchon, in southeast Thailand. And he has a number of Western disciples, including Ajahn Kalyano and Ajahn Achalo. And now I'm going to read a formal talk from the same person, Ajahn Anand. And this is from the last talk in a book titled Seeking Buddha. It's available for free distribution and for free online. I mention this also because I'll only be able to read the beginning and the end because it's quite a long talk. And I'll start with the introduction. Keeping the end in mind. This is an abridged version of a farewell Dhamma Desana delivered by Venerable Ajahn Anand at Wat Pha Krom, Chittabawanaram, Lam Luka, Pathum Thani, in November 1984, as he prepared to depart to continue his practice in Rayong province at what would later become his present-day residence of Wat Mopchon. In the course of this talk, Ajahn Anand offers the details of his practice as a gift of Dhamma, to gladden and inspire all those who had provided support during the years he spent practicing at Wat Pha Krom. Today, with the permission of Venerable Ajahn Piak and my friends in Dhamma, the time has come for me to speak about Dhamma practice, in the course of which there will be much food for thought to bring into your own practice of meditation. Therefore, let us all be determined to firmly compose the mind, to make it calm and peaceful by trying to focus upon the in and out breathing. Meditate feeling content and at ease, allowing the breathing to be comfortable and relaxed. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Having this opportunity to meet here today is because of our interest in Dhamma and our attempt to practice meditation in accordance with the advice and instruction of the Lord Buddha. Today, then, is a good opportunity for me to speak the truth about my own practice. Today seems the right occasion to speak because, for all of us to be sitting here, having lived this far, is indeed a rarity. Perhaps next year, or in the years ahead, we will not have the chance to meet together or see each other again. This or that person may have left us, some to other places, some because old age prevents them from coming, and some because of death. Therefore, the Buddha taught us that our lives are uncertain. Death is for sure. It is certain we must die. Our lives will end in death. When we foresee the danger in life's uncertainty, we become one who is heedful. The Buddha stated that the one who is heedful never dies. Appamado amata padang, pamado matruno padang. Heedfulness is the path to deathless. The one who is heedless is dead already. Such people, although still alive and sitting, standing, or walking, are said to have already died because they are dead to virtue and to goodness, to merit and to that which is wholesome. However, all of us sitting here can be described as heedful, trying to be interested and attentive in the practice of Dhamma that will brighten, cleanse, and purify our hearts in accordance with our efforts. Death, therefore, can become a wellspring of Dhamma. The Buddha informed us that the mind of one who frequently contemplates death will become heedful of the truth, recollecting the impermanence, suffering, and selflessness of this body. Just this subject of death, then, can become a basis for our meditation, a foundation for our practice that we cannot overlook. If we frequently practice Maranānusati, contemplating death as a meditation theme, our minds will become heedful of life's uncertainty and the certainty of death. We have to die for sure. This life will end in death. Some people, after conception, die in the womb. Others pass away after a couple of months or a couple of years, or after reaching the age of 10 or 20. This we can observe for ourselves. Our human lifespan, therefore, is uncertain. Some die young, and others die old. If we contemplate death in this way, then whatever power and prestige one may possess, whatever riches, rank, and renown, whether a prince or a pauper, a beggar or a billionaire, even great and mighty kings, we can see that death grants no exemptions. Even our supremely enlightened Lord Buddha, the Mahāparisa, the champion of the world, the refuge of all beings, fully endowed with the virtues of wisdom, great compassion, moral discipline, and absolute purity, even the life of that sublime one's body was crushed by death. Will we then, as ordinary people not yet possessing the wisdom, purity, power, and might of a Buddha, escape death and the danger inherent in death? Will we not have to be parted from all that we love and delight in? I myself will not escape death. It is beyond the ability of anyone. I consider my life to be uncertain, whereas death is a certainty. Consequently, everyone in this world is in the same predicament. Nobody can escape from death. Death will envelop us all, ending in separation from everything we love and cherish. All our wealth and possessions are gained with great difficulty. Some people amass a great stash, but are afraid to put it to use, whereas others are thrifty misers and hoard their wealth away. When they pass on, these goods and riches are unable to bring them any benefits. Why do we act like this? Because, like children playing in the garden as a blazing fire approaches, we do not yet see the danger closing in. Most of us are like these children having fun and frolics. We are unaware of the threat, unaware of the danger closing in, creeping slowly, relentlessly, upon us, second by second, minute by minute. That is, old age, sickness, and death. In the end, death comes to separate us from our bodies. However, it does not just part us from our own bodies. It also parts us from our children and spouses, our parents and relatives. Death separates and takes away that which we most love. How is it possible that death can take these things away from us? For the reason that these things are not within our power to control. Separation through death is a natural law. The law of death is a force of nature. After hearing the teaching of the Buddha, Venerable Anya Kondanya saw the truth because he understood how all things naturally arise and pass away. The meaning of all things here is everything that exists, everything that is subject to the conditions of impermanent suffering and not self. Where no self or soul or person or being or me or you can be found. Venerable Anya Kondanya saw his body as impermanent suffering and not self, as arising and ceasing, as being without a being. When one understands these natural conditions, as did Anya Kondanya, it is called attaining the vision of Dhamma. That is, he saw the physical body according to reality. When the world is seen according to reality, the vision of Dhamma arises. This is a profound transformation. The heart is transformed from that of an ordinary person. It changes from a Kalyana jhana to an Arya jhana, from just simply a good person to a noble one. When the Dhamma is seen, it is just this Dhamma which makes the heart noble. How is it that the heart becomes noble by seeing the Dhamma? It is because of being heedful, like Venerable Anya Kondanya. Before the Buddha's enlightenment, Venerable Kondanya was diligent in serving and ministering to the Bodhisattva for 6 years. However, after he saw the Buddha-to-be partake of nourishing food, Venerable Kondanya shunned him and ran away, believing it unlikely that the Buddha would attain to any lofty spiritual realization. Although Venerable Kondanya renounced the Bodhisattva, he did not abandon his own practice. He was possessed of faith, and having already put forth effort to build and perfect spiritual qualities, he realized that by continuing to cultivate Dhamma in this way, his heart would likely gain a firm spiritual foundation, a natural source of confidence and purity. Therefore, I would like to encourage you all to thoroughly investigate this subject of death. The contemplation of death, skillfully cultivated as a basic meditation practice, naturally brings many benefits. All anxiety, worry, and worldly concerns will inevitably be eliminated from our hearts as a matter of course. For this reason, then, we should all put forth effort in our meditation and try to make the investigation and contemplation of death firm in our minds. Try to develop this meditation as much as possible, investigating with determination and resolution for the sake of results. Sometimes, during our investigation of death, the heart experiences sudden flashes of sangvega, a profound sadness, with the sobering insight that life is uncertain, and that if we are destined to die, then nothing is worth clinging on to. With the arising of sangvega in the heart like this, it can be said that our contemplation of the meditation theme is correct and proper. If our mind experiences sudden moments of calm, which then turns into wayward thinking, this shows that the mind is concentrated to the level of khanika samadhi. If the calm in the mind goes deeper than this, which, when applied to the contemplation of the meditation theme, arouses feelings of sangvega and spiritual rapture, the sangvega arising only momentarily leaving behind an experience of deep bliss, peace, and serenity, then this indicates that the mind is entering upon upachara samadhi. This is a samadhi which is almost solid, sustained for long periods of time, and where body and mind are light and tranquil. If we use our minds to frequently contemplate in this way, then solid concentration will arise as a matter of course. This can be called cultivating wisdom to develop samadhi. That is to say, we contemplate using the mind to see impermanence, suffering, and not self, to see that this body will have to die. To arouse the theme of death in the mind, we must use our memory of those things we have heard and remembered to guide our contemplation. As the mind converges, it gradually calms down, advancing in stages from Kanaka Samadhi to Upachara Samadhi. As proficiency in samadhi increases, the contemplation of death becomes more skillful and effortless accordingly. In my own practice, I used Maranānusati, the contemplation of death, as my first basic theme of meditation. I made an effort to recollect death all the time. For example, sometimes I would watch children playing football, observing their delight in the world and their experience of pleasant, desirable moods. I would reflect, these our bodies cannot be taken for granted. Do these people who come looking for entertainment and distraction realize that death is creeping up on them? I too am no exception. If I could die right now, or at any moment, then why do I allow myself to seek only delight and distraction in the world? When I opened a newspaper and saw the daily announcements that this or that person had died, and that the funeral chanting would be conducted in such a monastery at such and such a time, then I would reflect that these people, although of rank, fame, and fortune, they still had to meet with death and disaster. Previously, they were alive just as I am now, and in the end, like them, I naturally will have to die. Contemplating in this way, the mind became calm and Sangvega arose. This is called making an effort to develop the recollection of death as a basic meditation practice. In my practice, I continually put forth effort to develop the meditation on death. For the first 4 years, I was still developing the contemplation of death as my main theme of meditation. So now I'll go to the end in the interest of time, but he goes in quite a lot of detail through the progression of his practice. So this is the conclusion. In as much of my practice as I have related here, in conclusion, it is enough to say that I put forth effort, keeping a solid foundation in sila. As a layman, I practice generosity. I would consider, my life is uncertain, whereas death is a certainty. I surely will have to die. My life will end in death. If death is coming, then what's the point of amassing wealth and possessions? Regardless of how much I make plans to save or become self-made and secure, life is uncertain. Sometimes the money and assets that I have sought out are not even put to use. Consequently, I tried to practice dana and establish myself in this quality of generosity and self-sacrifice. I gave freely of my resources on a regular basis until one day I asked myself why I was working, considering I gave most of my monthly wage away as gifts or offerings, using only the little that remained to support myself. I reflected, what's the reason for working if I give away all that I make? It's better I ordain and seek freedom from suffering. I put forth effort in practicing generosity to establish myself in noble spiritual qualities. When I performed deeds of generosity, gradually the heart became more self-sacrificing and the power of selfish greed was restrained. Consequently, my heart conceived the wish to ordain. I no longer want to earn a living. A worldly person would call such individuals feeble, labeling them as life's losers. However, for those following the way of Dhamma, such wishes and wants are called seeing the danger in the cycle of death and rebirth. The danger is seen in that, although our good deeds lead on to goodness, acts of evil plunge us down the abyss to a hellish birth, becoming animals, demons, or hungry ghosts, where there is a total suffering and misery. Consequently, not taking birth is more favorable. It is better to seek freedom from suffering, to strive in the quest for liberation. I will soon be traveling to Rayong province and will probably take up residence there. As a monk and a samana, refraining from the pursuit of wealth, I have nothing except the Dhamma teachings of the Lord Buddha and my own practice of meditation with which to repay the kindness of all the lay supporters here at Lamluka. Every one of you faithful devotees has always made your best effort to attentively support the monks and novices. If I had not sincerely practiced, it is likely I would be unable to repay this karmic debt. Initially in my practice, aware of this indebtedness, I was wary and apprehensive when I saw faithful supporters bringing the four requisites to offer. However, I tried hard practicing to make myself noble and worthy so that all my supporters would find peace and contentment. Consequently, seeing the faith of all the lay supporters here at Lamluka, I rejoice in your goodness and in your wholesome aspirations. Finally, may the power of the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha aid and assist all of you sitting here and all those who come to make merit here at Lamluka. May your hearts be calm and serene, firm in samadhi, shining bright. May you all abandon evil, do that which is good, and purify the heart, freeing it from suffering and arousing the vision of Dhamma.
Reflections on Ajahn Chah. Mm-hmm. When I was in Thailand, I got to spend a couple of days with him in Kalyano. We had him give me a private interview. And I was really struck that every single question I asked, he said, well, Ajahn Chah said, this is how Ajahn Chah would teach. Mm-hmm. And every single answer, he sort of deferred to Ajahn Chah. Mm-hmm. It was really struck.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's very accomplished. In his own practice and his many capabilities, the three Ajahn Anand, Ajahn Dan, and Ajahn Biak were very close friends that made a connection in their very early days. They came to Wat Pa Pong around the same time. And they made a very close connection with each other. They also, I imagine they had karma connections from the past. That they're all central ties, so that they were, and in those days there was hardly any central ties. So they were kind of, outsiders at Wat Pa Pong, and then they all are very accomplished in their practice, very diligent. And Ajahn Anand was asked particular qualities that he had or they had, and he said, "Well, Ajahn Dan his path is really the path of wisdom. He's very accomplished in his, that's his sort of strength and his foundation. Ajahn Biak is extremely gifted as a in samadhi, said, and I have very strong faith. So the reality is also that he is both. He's very good. They're all very good. Say samadhi is something that is quite. But each of them had particular inclinations that were their kind of what they were most comfortable with, or what their kind of their particular inclination. But Ananda, very very strong faith and very faithful. Respect towards Ajahn Chah in particular.
That's kind of, it seems kind of unusual for a monk to kind of give a talk like this one, where he talks about his meditative accomplishments, the things that happened to him in meditation. Something mm-hmm. that was covered in, it was read out, but still I'm familiar with it.
Right.
Is that increasingly common, or is it really unusual, or frowned upon, or
I think it's situational, in the sense that he's leaving the monastery and leaving the area, and I think wanting to leave something that encouraged people, both the lay community in particular, but there'd be a group of monks that would be still staying say at the monastery and continuing to practice and train there, so that to leave something that uplifts and encourages. I think his approach is one of this is what can happen when you reflect and investigate and are heedful and put forth that. It's not a personal thing.
Did Ajahn Piak and Ajahn Anand kind of leave Wapapong together to go to establish Wapakram, or was it?
Yeah, actually the three of them. Ajahn Ban and Ajahn, I think Ajahn Chah sent them down there.
Back to Central Thailand.
Yeah, go down deal with those Central Thailand. But because the piece of land had been offered, and so that I can't remember the timing, they would probably have five or six buses, and it's sort of the time when you go off to Dong looking for experiences. And I said, well, here's this piece of land. There's nothing there. Why don't you go down and practice there and see what comes of it? The lay people are have some interest. So it's giving them something to do.
Is this the monastery that's Wapa comes near the airport?
It's near the old airport. It used to be
nowhere.
Nowhere. It was just this out in these fields and there was nothing there.
It's all hemmed in now.
Really hemmed in. I mean, that back wall is the back of these big, two-story townhouses type thing, or houses. And yes, the evening time comes along, and what everybody's cooking. and on that side, and then there's a big housing estate on the other side, and then there's kind of a The other part in the front and the back is, you know, it's just pretty.
Yeah, where the narrow streets around it. Is.
Yeah.
when he left to go to Realm, had Ajahn Dunn already left as well? Or?
No, he and Ajahn Dunn, I think, went out together.
Oh, did they go to Realm together?
Because Ajahn Dunn stayed for, I think, maybe 2 years at the place in Realm. And helped Ajahn Dunn out, and then he wandered off to Realm after that, and then came across this piece of land in where his monastery is now.
How long do you know how long Ajahn Dunn was there at Wat Phat Krom from the time he got there to the time he left? Was that like a
let's see, year? In 1984, probably 3-4 years.
3-4 years.
Three, four years. Guess. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a guess. I was just wanting to know, Lumpur, if you had any advice around Marini Sati in terms of the sense I often have is, you know, I bring up death and focus on it, and the mind is not so interested, and sometimes it can get interested, but not really, and then other times. And it sort of bounces off, you know, just sort of rather be doing something else. And then the other times are when there are these rare occasions, which used to happen more as a layperson, where it would become very heavy and I'd realize, yes, this is an absolute certainty. Mm-hmm. And then it would be a very heavy experience.
Yeah.
And and then the mind also doesn't want to stay with that. It'll stay with it for only so long, even though that's the real, that's it. Like, that's okay, that's what I want.
Mm-hmm.
And do you have any advice around how to navigate that? I mean, is it just kind of just hitting one's head against the kind of marvelous?
Well, I mean, you can't. Yeah, I mean, you can't sort of bash away it too much, because then it just is. I mean, that's oppressive as well. Just doing something simple, like breathe in and don't breathe out. What's that feel like? What's that mean? You think, right, death is like this, it's right here. It's not a, not a concept. This is, it's not because, we don't have the control to say, oh yeah, I'm going to keep myself healthy and alive, and it just isn't possible just by nature. So doing something very simple like that reinforces that sense of all right, right. This is, it's really present. It's really close by. That's the. It's only, there's just as you're contemplating in a, and not in some kind of catastrophic way, but in something very simple. Sometimes, just like, okay, breathing in and not breathing out, that's okay, there it is. Or just contemplating, eating something and then choking and passing away. I mean, it's that easy. there's all sorts of besides the kind of catastrophic illnesses that are possible. You know, just even ordinary things that we do can easily end in our death. So, like Jnanko, having that Maka Putanka slipped and fell, or had something happen that hit his head and he was dead. Right? Or by the window, going to the toilet, and then it's just an assumption. It was that he was standing up and just having low blood pressure or something, passing out, fainting quickly, probably just a slight lapse of fainting, but then going forward, hitting his head. And Ajahn Jayasarma said, there's only one possible way he could have fallen in order to break his neck like that, and he managed to do it. And it was just sort of, just these things can happen. So the frailty of the human body. And it's, the reality is that it's incredibly resilient as well, but if you're using it as a contemplation for bringing up that sense of samvega and an urgency, and so to take things that are very close to one and very on a certain level mundane.
In piggyback to that topic, for a layperson, it seems to bring up more confusion than it does like samvega. Like, well, I'm not going to be a monk here, and yet most of the rest of this stuff seems pretty useless. So now what do I do?
The thing is, that's kind of a cop-out. I mean, sort of like that's a deferring, pushing the contemplation away so you don't actually have to take it on board, because it's not a matter of being a monk or not being a monk. It's actually human existence is like this, and what do I do to live within this human existence in a way that is clear and wise and noble?
So taking account of circumstance.
Mm-hmm.
Taking an account circumstance and then just doing the best.
Well, it's just the reality, the human existence. It's not sort of about being a monk or not being a monk. It's about being a human being that's subject to aging, sickness, and death. And that, somebody who is that is present and wise and skillful. It doesn't matter where they live. I mean, it's beneficial.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it isn't as if you go back out into the world and you're not going to die. You're just going to die if you're in the monastery.
There can be a belief. I know, Thai people or Asian people won't say it directly, but there is a belief like if you contemplate death, you might call it to you or bring it to you. So that's another cop out.
It's just sort of fear, and it's finding a way to not have to bother doing it. Just finding an excuse. It prioritizes everything.
One thing that I find about Mahayana Sati is that it does sort of prioritize things, but it's I find it really easy to get my mind, or my mind to go running off into thinking about rebirth, about past lives and future lives. And, it's because, I don't know exactly why, but it's kind of like, I'll forget to die then, what? Why should I worry?
That's the engineer. Just get the mechanics of this down.
Exactly. so I kind of, I actually have a bit of a struggle, not struggle, but I have to kind of be, use a light touch with it, just sort of use it to build a little bit of motivation and drop it before.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, whatever, because that's something that's important to reflect on. It doesn't matter what practice that one picks up. How does one use it so that it leads to disenchantment, dispassion, to cessation, to peace, to putting things down, relinquishing. So that that's more the, kind of bottom line is where one has to keep reflecting, what, you know, regardless of whatever practice or reflection it is.
So Ajahn Anand, I think Ajahn Tanimo was saying that Ajahn Anand actually had, you know, access or whatever, maybe there was like visions of the Pure Land. And when Ajahn Dam was here, there was a question of him, and he said, I think it was a monk asking, like, after you die, and maybe you think you're not going to make it, you know, to Nibbana, like, practically speaking, like, what would you recommend to that kind of person? Some kind of question like that, Ajahn Dam was saying, like, a response, something like, you could aspire to be, does anyone else remember? You could aspire to be reborn at the time of, whatever the next Buddha is. There's some kind of answer like that, like, yeah, be reborn in the heaven until the next Buddha comes. So actually making those aspirations. And is this anything that Lumpur Cha, to be reach anything close to this, or is this, no?
That's those central ties. They're always a big fun. No, I mean, Ajahn Chah is, you know, he's a villager. He's a northeasterner. These are really kind of salt of the earth people. Under the idea of, he would actually sort of really poo poo the idea of say, yeah, because it is. It's part of Thai culture, you know, throughout all of Thailand. That aspiration for being reborn, basically that you've missed the boat this lifetime because you didn't meet the, you know, you've missed the previous Buddha by like 2500 years, and it's, you know, it's just this really the degenerate age, and you know, all you can really do is just get, you know, make that happen. Do meritorious deeds, make aspirations to be born with them when the Ariyamaitarna arises, and then you'll be able to practice. Ajahn Chah would just rip people up and down with that, is there, because that sense of, you know, it doesn't matter what, and if you present moment, how are you practicing? How are you working with the present moment? If you're deferring practice now to some future time, yeah, even if Ariyamaitaya shows up, you'll be looking for some other Buddha. Mm-hmm. Now's the time to practice.
Mm-hmm. I heard some senior monk in Thailand say you're lazy now, and you'll be lazy when the Maitreya comes.
I think I recall another one, like, do you think Maitreya's time is going to be any different?
Yeah, and that's the reality, is that, you know, the actual truth is truth is the truth. Whether Buddhas appear in the world or don't appear in the world, all formations are impermanent, all formations are non-self, all dhammas are anatta. That's the bottom line. That one can be contemplating, reflecting on that.
I like your reflection as well on this that you've talked about before, which is, it's a crap shot, it's Russian roulette. And you really need to know that and be ready for it, because it's not necessarily going to get any better.
Oh, yeah.
So long.
Yeah.
Comment can catch up to you.
think in terms of the, especially if you start making aspirations for the future. The scale of time is so sort of vast. You can miss it by a couple of eons.
There's another sort of approach to this that I've reflected on. In that, in the canon, there are two classes. The lowest two classes of noble beings are the faith follower and the Dhamma follower. These are beings who, at least as far as I read the canon, basically aren't Sotapanna yet, but they've accomplished enough that they'll realize it, you know, that they will realize that at the moment of death, when death comes knocking.
Yeah.
The other thing about those two categories is, unlike the Sotapanna, they probably don't know themselves either, because there's just not the knowledge there.
Yeah.
So my sense has always been, okay, well, aim for that. You know, if you know you don't know, and so you know you aim, you and I mean, my understanding is that's no different than just doing the practice.
Yeah. I mean, that's the it's an interesting point, and of course it's been debated for 2,500 years, but it is a very really interesting perspective, because in the canon, that it really seems to be the case that faith follower, Dhamma follower, that on the breakup of the body, all of a sudden everything becomes very clear, and the catalyst is there for the entering the stream. And that is a really interesting, because also just in a little way, without imputing anything, say people who had near-death experiences almost always come back with a very different take on life. Or there is a really transformative quality when the mind becomes extremely still and settled and the body drops away. There's a kind of a recognition of, oh yeah, this whole sort of thing that I take as me is really not so solid. And that moment of death is even more potent. Mm-hmm. Everything that one assumed is really not. It's like Ajahn Chah sort of saying, when he came down from the mountain in whatever it was, Puhua, he said he looked at things and nothing was the same anymore.
I think Ajahn Lama says, like, at the moment of death, exactly around this topic, he said at the moment of death, it's like, oh yeah, it really never was mine to begin with. Just realizing it. This I've just been fooled for something.
Yeah, that's where the contemplation of death is so important, because it familiarizes the mind with that, and it's comfortable rather than resisting reacting out of fear or desire or trying to get out of it. When one contemplates death, then there's a familiarity and, I wouldn't say ease or comfort with it, but not just blindly reacting out of, fear or aversion or desire.
Yeah. Also, sort of backtracking to Tom Kimiko's question, one thing that I found helpful to bring that reflection of death into the moment, into the present moment, while also considering future rebirth, is to ask the question: if I were to die at this instant, mm-hmm. what am I? You know, what would I? You know, be reborn as? Because, you know, if your current mental state, whatever you're grasping at, conditioned your current experience, it's dang well going to condition your next one.
Yeah.
And so that tends to snap me out of whatever it is that I'm grasping.
Yeah, like in the Tibetan structure of things, the bargos. But basically, the bargo is what mental state wants. Okay, that's what one's experiencing. And what one is drawn into, to say it's worth. That's a good reflection.
So you said a controversy about like what happens at that moment of death in the sort of Dhamma follower, faith follower. Bhante Gunaratna said if you want to get a group of Sri Lankans fighting with each other, just put Sarakhani, the drunk Sarakhani.
Oh, yes.
He says it will always end up in an argument.
Yeah.